Well, the regulation of charities, particularly religious charities, is being significantly overhauled. The new Charities Act removes the presumption that religious groups are for the public benefit. In future, churches and Christian organisations will have to prove that they are for the public benefit. Well, how will this term, public benefit, be interpreted? Well, that question is at the heart of our concerns. I should say right at the start that in theory, the charitable status of churches is unlikely to change. They can easily demonstrate public benefit because, for example, they hold public services of worship. Whilst evangelism is going to continue to be permitted, there is a concern that the Commission seems to disapprove of evangelism which selectively targets members of one particular faith. So what about Jews for Jesus? What about an evangelistic charity which works in the inner city and works to share the faith with Muslims that are around them? There is also concern that the Christian charities involved with some hot potato issues. What about those charities that have values that are out of kilter with the tenets of political correctness? There's concerns there that I want to come back to in a moment. It's timely that we consider this issue today because the Charity Commission are about to issue specific guidance for religious charities. And it's great that everyone's here because I hope you'll all respond to that particular consultation. So let's first of all look at what a charity is. Well, it's a non-profit organisation registered, recognised by the state as having charitable purposes and which exists for the public benefit. There are many financial benefits to being a charity, principally tax relief, no income tax or corporation tax to pay, no tax on investments, community charge relief, that's at least a discount of 80%, in many areas 90% off the rates, no VAT on advertising for fundraising, no VAT on construction of new buildings, and preferential rates from banks and suppliers. Charities also have the advantage that their status confers respect. Their finance and their conduct are regulated. That's a selling point. This encourages people to support charities. It gives people confidence to make donations. No church would find it easy to give up all of these benefits. And the good news is no one is asking them to. Parliament is not requiring churches to give up these benefits. And there's much that we can do now to help churches in the future. Let's look at charity law. This determines which organisations are charities. This has been laid down by Parliament in successive pieces of legislation, starting with the Charitable Uses Act of 1601. But charity law has been largely made by judges. This is called case law. In 1891, a prominent judge, Lord McNaghten, set out four heads of charity. One, the relief of poverty. Two, the advancement of religion. Three, the advancement of education. And four, a sort of sweep-up clause, any other purposes beneficial to the community, not within the other three heads. That's the pencil case. Case law established that a presumption exists for the first three heads. So if you had a charity for relief of poverty, it was presumed that was for the public benefit. Same with advancement of religion or education. It didn't have to be assessed. It was presumed unless there was a case of doubt or ambiguity. The presumption was only overturned if there was compelling evidence to do so. And charities falling under the fourth head that I mentioned, the sweep-up clause, had to prove public benefit in each and every case. So that was an entirely different category. Now, there are two key principles of case law that set the ground rules for religious charities. First, there's no discrimination between religions. Over the past 75 years, the courts have consistently refused to rule on which religion is true or beneficial. As far as the courts are concerned, any religion will do. Except in the most extreme cases, all religions are treated in the same way. As Lord Reed said in 1949, a religion can be regarded as beneficial without it being necessary to assume that all its beliefs are true. And a religious service, that's a church service, or some other religious service, can be regarded as beneficial to all those who attend it without it being necessary to determine the spiritual efficacy of that service or to accept any particular belief about it. In 1963, Justice Wilberforce said, "The court cannot discriminate between religions." In 1981, Justice Walton concluded, "It has long been settled that the law presumes that it is better for a man to have a religion, a set of beliefs to take him outside his own petty cares and lead him to think of others, rather than to have no religion at all." The second fundamental ground is that the requirement of religion, that this is the requirement that religion must be advanced. Now, charity law distinguishes between private religious devotion, which is not charitable, and the advancement of religious belief, which is. In the words of Lord Denning, "When a man prays in the privacy of his own bedroom, he may truly be concerned with religion, but not with the advancement of religion." So you can pray in your bedroom. That's religion, no doubt about that, but you're not concerned with the advancement of religion. In 1931, a case held that the promotion of religion is the promotion of spiritual teaching in a wide sense, and the maintenance of the doctrines on which it rests, and the observances that serve to promote and manifest it. The promotion of spiritual teaching and the maintenance of doctrines would cover preaching, door-to-door evangelism, street preaching, Sunday school classes, midweek Bible studies, church newsletters, or any other means to promote the gospel, such as websites, radio, or TV. Observances would embrace an act of worship, such as a church service, to which members of the public are admitted, and also wider as well. Now, these two ground rules of case law fit very well with the activities of evangelical churches, which seek to proclaim the gospel and welcome outsiders into their service of worship. You might wish that your particular church, your particular evangelical view that you have on church government or whatever, would be the true religion recognized by the court. But I would suggest to you that's a dangerous way to go down, isn't it? You're having a secular judge adjudicate on what's true, what's false. So whenever judges have been faced with that, they said, "I don't want to know. We'll just not discriminate between religions." I'd like now to turn to the new law, the Charities Act 2006. The legislation affects charities in many ways. For example, the creation of 9 new distinct heads of charity. And you can see those on this sheet here. They're all set out. So there's 9 new heads of charity. There's the existing 3. And then there's the sort of sweep-up clause at the very end, other purposes recognised as a charitable. And it's sort of by analogy, arguing it's something that looks like the others above, but doesn't quite fit in. So there's 13 heads of charity now. I want to consider the changes in the legislation that deal with public benefit. There are many other things as well in the Act, but let's just look at those affecting public benefit. The most radical change is that religious charities are all now going to have to prove public benefit. The same goes for educational charities and those concerned with the relief of poverty. The presumption established for hundreds of years has now been swept away. Under the old law, thousands of churches had little or no involvement with the Charity Commission. They were deemed to be charities. Now, unless they've got a very, very small turnover, they'll all have to register with the Commission for the first time. But they may have a breathing space. These churches will not have to register until 2012 if their turnover is less than £100,000 per year and they are on the list of accepted charities. This is laid down in regulations passed by Parliament. That's the list of churches there. The biggest, basically. But there are a number that wouldn't fit into that category. The FIC would have lots of individual chapels, and their membership, I think, is growing. It's not actually a denomination, but many are affiliating because there are benefits in being exempted immediately from the whole panoply of this charity law. But if you're on that list, you've got a little bit longer before you have to register if your turnover is less than £100,000. All other churches will have to register immediately now if they have an income of more than £5,000 a year. And that sort of de minimis may in fact rise. Some talk it may go to £10,000 or £15,000 a year, but at the moment it's £5,000. Let me mention some general things which actually turn out to be highly relevant to this. First, charities promoting atheism can now be registered. The Charity Commission has enhanced powers of supervision over charities, and charity appeal tribunals are to be set up as a counterbalance to a much more powerful regulator. The tribunals will be able to quash the decisions of the Commission, and their decisions will be binding unless overturned by High Court. And finally, there's a new requirement that charities must have regard to the Commission's guidance on public benefit. Now, having regard to means that the guidance is not necessarily binding, but it would be a foolish charity indeed which chose simply to ignore the guidance. The Commission is keen to assert that the case law on public benefit is unaffected by the 2006 Act. They say, our guidance set out a framework of factors to consider when assessing public benefit based on the principles of public benefit contained in existing case law. So they say that's basically going to be kept. Now, obviously, there are certain areas where the law will change, and that's obvious when you consider secular atheistic charities. They've not easily been able to be charities. Case law has been against that. Now legislation has been laid down to allow that. So the case law will be set to one side on that particular point. But in general, the Charity Commission is saying we are basing everything we say on existing case law that predates the 2006 Act. The Commission also say that as well as the courts and the charity appeal tribunals, the law will be developed by them. Now, in some areas, I'll be talking about in a moment, the Commission are emphasising some aspects of the law, some aspects of the case law, without taking on board judgments which seem to balance out the argument. In some areas, they seem to be taking a bit of a skew view of the law. There is excellent case law which certainly defends the activities of evangelical churches. The precedents may well need to be quoted more often by us and cited against particular views of the Commission. Let's now just look at a bit of background, a bit of political background to what's been going on. As far as public benefit is concerned, there are four factors which have influenced the recent decision, recent legislation, and its implementation. The first is out-of-date historic trust deeds. There are a number of old charities that were set up to operate under conditions which no longer apply today. The Charity Commission love to quote one particular example of hospital comfort funds. These were set up to give out cigarettes to soldiers in hospital in the Second World War. Now today, patients can't smoke in their beds and doctors strongly disapprove of smoking, particularly their patients smoking. Now, undoubtedly then, there are some charities whose trust deeds are frozen in time, and the Commission wants to be able to ensure that funds given to a charity are used in a manner as close as possible to the original purpose. This is the so-called CPRE doctrine. It's a very long-standing doctrine in charity law, and the Commission hopes that the Charities Act will speed up the process in reassigning these funds. Second factor, public schools. You can't have missed this. There is a view that public schools should be required to give something back to the community in return for their charitable status. Removing the presumption and requiring evidence of public benefit is seen as a way of compelling such schools to change their practice. I've no doubt it's one of the main reasons why the presumption was lost. That's one of the main motives, political motives, for removing the presumption, not only from educational charities, but also they thought, well, if we're going to do it for them, we might as well do religion and poverty as well, because equality is good for all. So they think. Next factor, extremist religious charities. Now, to be fair, we know there are some religious charities which have given cause for concern. For example, the authorities are alarmed about Islamic charities run by extremist groups. Recently, the Charity Commission took over Finsbury Park Mosque in London. And a whole monitoring unit has been established at the Commission, euphemistically called the Faith and Social Cohesion Unit. And they are looking at basically terrorists masquerading and passing themselves off as charities and the money coming from abroad and all that sort of thing. So that's another factor that's going on. And then the final thing is the Human Rights Act. Now, the Charities Act takes the principle of non-discrimination one stage further. It says now you can be an atheist and promote atheism and you can be a charity. Before, that was quite difficult. Now it's to be made much easier. The problem for the Commission is this. Once the doors have been opened to allow non-theistic groups to be charities, then the Human Rights Act makes it much harder to close the door on cults and political groups which may be seeking charitable status. And I believe this is one reason why the Commission are very keen on having a public benefit test. Now, so far, the Commission has always been able to stop Scientology succeeding in becoming a charity. And it may be, under the new regime, they will lose that battle. The Human Rights Act enforces religious neutrality. It doesn't matter whether you're an Orthodox Christian or you believe that Elvis Presley was the Son of God. If your belief is sufficiently coherent, then it falls to be protected under the European Convention on Human Rights. So it's no wonder that the Commission has sought greater legal powers. These powers could potentially, this is the point, these powers could be potentially used against evangelical charities. So there may be a whole bunch of reasons why these powers have been used, nothing to do with evangelical charities, but the same powers could be used in another way. But Christians can also use the Human Rights Act, which says, well, equal rules for all. You know, you're complaining about the way we're speaking. What about all these other charities, the way they're speaking too? You don't like what we're saying? What about them? Are you allowing them to speak as well? So the Human Rights Act could also be used defensively, I believe. Now, there are two specific sets of guidance. The general guidance, which you've got in your pack, that's this document here. It's published in January on charities and public benefit. That's final. And all charities must comply with that. And second, which we've not seen, the sector-specific guidance for religious charities. And that's going out to consultation soon. It's going to be published. And you'll have an opportunity to respond to it. And it will be crucial that many Christians do respond to it. Let's consider the document that has been published, the general guidance for all charities. I'm going to ask you just to get the little summary of that here. And can you turn to page 2? So the heading is public benefit, and you see two principles. The Commission has set out two key principles of public benefit for all charities. Within these principles, there are criteria which must be satisfied in every case. So you've got principle 1. There must be an identifiable benefit or benefits. 1A, it must be clear what the benefits are. 1B, the benefits must be related to the aims. 1C, benefits must be balanced against any detriment or harm. Principle 2. Benefit must be to the public or section of the public. 2A, the beneficiaries must be appropriate to the aims, and so on, all the way through Principle 2. Now, in general, evangelical churches are extremely keen for members of the public to come along to their church. So in the language of charity law, evangelical churches are very, very keen to increase the number of beneficiaries. Just what the Commission wants charities to do. Of course, we want to make our own rules on doctrine, what we believe, on the administration of sacraments, who can be a leader, and on the issue of church membership. But in general, we're very, very keen for people to come along to church and to take part in what we're doing. Now, whilst monasteries might be worried about principle two, I don't think evangelical churches need to have much worry at all. The problem will only come when principle two, dealing with exclusion, is combined with principle 1c. So that's really what I want to focus in on. It's principle one that I think we need to concentrate on. The first two factors, principle 1a and 1b, being clear what the benefits are and that the benefits must be related to the aims, I think are things that we can deal with quite easily. Just one point, though, to raise. As far as the law is concerned, the promise of eternal life is an intangible concept. It's an intangible benefit. So is the forgiveness of sins. But thankfully, the Commission accept that for religious charities, most of their benefits are intangible. But the emphasis that I've picked up from talking to Commission staff is that religious charities need to go further and set up some of their tangible benefits, set out some of the things you can actually measure and get hold of. So how are we then to demonstrate public benefit? Well, I want to particularly look at the issue of a church, but I think some of the principles would apply to a Christian organisation too. We must continue to argue, primarily, that the public benefit of churches and other Christian charities is to meet spiritual needs. That is absolute. It's the gospel. It's delivering somebody from eternal death and giving them eternal life. It's dealing with those intangible things. That's the primary benefit. Now, as I said, the Commission wants charities to go further. Religious charities are going to have to name some of their tangible benefits as well as their intangible ones. We don't know exactly how that will work out because the Charity Commission are going to tell us what you're going to have to put in your annual report. There's going to be a whole section of the annual report detailing how you benefit the public. You're going to have to set it out. But they've not published the rules on that yet. But here are some of the things that I've got some ideas that from talking to various charity lawyers that a church could put down on their statement of public benefit. I'm not suggesting that churches would do all of these things, but one or two might be quite useful. You can talk about your church services are open to the public. You can tell them about the details of the services that you hold. You can say, well, this number of people attended our church regularly every week, and this number of people came through the doors in any one year. You can give details of outreach activities. You can talk about the number of new people who are coming to church. You can talk about the range of groups within the church, the work with old people, young people, women's prayer meeting, and so forth. And you can talk about the numbers of attending those different groups. And you can talk about the spread of backgrounds, races, and cultures of people who attend church. And perhaps also some testimonies of people who have been helped. Now, this information is far, far more than any church would need to put in. But it's the sort of thing that might give you some ideas. For larger charities and denominations, it might be appropriate to mention the following tangible benefits. You could talk about Christian belief, offering a set of values by which people live and make decisions as to how they relate and interact with fellow human beings. You could talk about morality and ethics being the basis of civilized behavior. And you can talk about academic research, which shows that the Christian faith is good for people's psychological well-being. And there's all sorts of other academic research showing there are many health benefits and other benefits too in being a Christian. So that's really how to satisfy principle 1c and 1b. I don't think that's a real problem. What I've talked about is really complete overkill. You won't have to do anything like that level of detail. But let's focus now in on the thing that really is crucial. That's principle 1c, the balance of harm test. And what does principle 1c mean? Under the previous law, the presumption of public benefit could be rebutted if there was evidence to the contrary. Christian churches were automatically charities. They were weighed through the public benefit barrier. No doubt a bogus church, which never held a service, would be struck off the register. But things had to get pretty bad and pretty extreme before anybody was worried. In essence, the Old Test was concerned with the purpose of a charity, what a charity is, rather than what it does. But the New Test is concerned with the activities of a charity. Officials at the Commission now say they want to weigh up what they consider to be the good and bad activities of a charity. In their words, any benefits must be balanced against detriment or harm. I call this the balance of harm test. Although a charity may be able to show they're doing great things, wonderful things, this could be entirely outweighed by negative factors. Now, where does all this come from? What's the legal basis? Well, it turns out the idea of weighing up benefits and detriments is based on one single case. At least that's all I've found. In the Commission's analysis of the law, which they've published, they cite only one case where they get this from. In 1948, the courts decided that the National Anti-Vivisection Society, committed to banning experiments on animals, they couldn't be a charity as the need to protect animal welfare was outweighed by the need for society to have scientific experiments conducted on animals. So the harm outweighed the good in the case of a charity that wanted to ban animal experiments. So they were, I think there had been a charity up to that point, they were deregistered. No other case has been cited except that one. So what are the concerns that this gives rise to? Well, I think there are two. Positivism, I've already mentioned. The staff at the Commission that I've talked to, they accept that most religious faiths proselytise. There are very few that don't. Orthodox Jews don't. But most other faiths do. They seek to convert other people. And the Commission are comfortable with this as a sideline. But what they don't like is the view that it's the exclusive activity. And the argument goes that although the proselytism is perfectly lawful, it shouldn't be charitable if it's exclusively the only thing that you do, because sole proselytism as an activity necessarily involves criticising other people's views. That's a dangerous way of thinking that I think we need to be concerned about. It's important to be concerned about that to protect evangelism and our missionary churches. Missionary organisations. So that's one concern. The second concern relates to organisations which promote contentious moral beliefs, such as pregnancy crisis centres or ministries that seek to help homosexuals leave their lifestyle. Those are going to be very contentious and difficult areas, I would predict. So how does this bite? How could the balance of harm test be wrongly used? Well, the Commission has now published the criteria. It's in that longer document that you've got. And the Commission say they will be on the lookout for three things. Unlawfully, anything that unlawfully restricts a person's freedom, anything that encourages or promotes violence or hatred towards others, and anything that's dangerous or damaging to mental health. Now, these words, as you read them, shouldn't be a problem for Christians, you would think. No Christian would want to promote violence or hatred. But just think for a moment also about how these words are bandied about. Gay rights groups, for example, regularly say that Christians are unlawfully trying to restrict their freedom. They are promoting hatred, they say. They say that Christian homophobia encourages violence. They say that Christian homophobia leads to gay men getting depressed and having their mental health damaged. So these words are easily capable of more than one interpretation. Many Christians are concerned about the subjective wording of the guidance, and this isn't helped by some of the other terminology in the guidance that the Commission has published. They say that their views will be influenced by, quotes, changes in social values and by what is relevant and appropriate for cultural and social and economic conditions. Now, most people, I think, would accept that you should no longer get tax relief for handing out cigarettes to patients in coronary care units. But forcing a hospital comfort fund to give out grapes instead might be perfectly legitimate. No problem about that. But seeking to impose secular values on religious bodies would not be appropriate, using this same sort of wording. Yet for all the caveats in the guidance, the Commission's wording seems to be open to that possible interpretation. The Commission also talk about the importance of public attitudes and opinion, and they say that that can be a useful factor which can come to shape the legal understanding of what is charitable. So even if some of these phraseologies aren't determinative on their own, they can be part of a decision which is used as to whether to register or deregister a charity. The final guidance does give cause for concern then, but I would say this on the positive side. On the upside, the final guidance is much better. It's a significant improvement on the draft that went out to consultation. It was even more, far worse than what we've got now. And the reason why it's better is that many evangelical charities and churches put in submissions. They were highly influential, and I can reckon, I can look through the public benefit guidance. I can say, yes, I saw that in the Lawyers Christian Fellowship submission. I saw that in our submission. So they've taken on board some of the points that we were making. And that's there. We can use those things anchored in the guidance to argue our case. So in conclusion then, what should we do? What should we do about all this? Well, first of all, I don't think we should do anything. At one level, we should do absolutely nothing at all, because there's no reason why churches cannot continue to be charities. They provide services of public worship to which the public can attend. That is a primary function of advancing religion. It's clearly a public benefit. Now, we're going to have a bit more paperwork to fill in. All churches and Christian organisations will have to spend time completing the new public benefits section of their annual report, and I'm advocating that we try and do that well. But secondly, we have to be as wise as serpents and as harmless as doves. Given the general secular direction of our society, problems might well arise, maybe not next year, maybe not the year after, but maybe in 5 years' time, when they come to look again at this guidance. The new version might be significantly worse. So we have to keep on arguing our case. We have to be firm on what we believe in all our dealings with the Commission. So I see no reason why Christians should deregister their charities. We should fight our corner. If a charity deregisters, there will be a loss of gift aid and 80% of community charge relief. Those will be the principal things that you'll notice immediately. And if that happens, then you should contact your tax office to get advice on whether there are tax implications. Probably there won't be. But I don't think a church needs to countenance that step at this stage. No reason. I mean, we don't want a Christianity tax, you know. Just because we're Christians, we can't be charities. If others can, we pay taxes too. Why should we be specially taxed to have churches? We don't accept that. So let's stay in and fight our corner. But that is always an option. You know, if we have to get to that, that's an option we can go to. But we don't need to go to that at the moment. You know, we don't need to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. I think that this particular issue can be fought, and I believe it can be won too. But I think at the moment that we've got a lot going for us, principally the excellent case law that we have. Fourthly, I would encourage Christian charities to be upfront about what you believe. Why should the Charity Commission think your beliefs are important if you can't be bothered to state them publicly? It's no good, you know, turning around to the Charity Commission and saying, well, actually, we really believe this. And they look at your website, they look at your materials, and they can't actually find what you believe. And so they're going to say, well, really, it can't be that important to you. Aren't you just producing this like a rabbit out of the hat? So say what you believe. Be very publicly upfront. And finally, would encourage you to take part in the Charity Commission consultation on religious charities. There's no doubt that many Christians have already influenced the general guidance, so let's influence the specific guidance governing churches and other Christian organisations. And if you're on our mailing list, we'll make sure that we'll send you some tips on how to take part in this key consultation. Thank you. So now...